Good afternoon, Mr. Lowe, whenever you're ready.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, I am Andrew Lowe, counsel for the appellants, whom I will refer to together as General Steele. The first point in this appeal is that the trial court erred in submitting to the jury the plaintiff's claim for abuse of process. We've covered that point very thoroughly in our briefs, though, so unless the court has questions about the abuse of process claim, I propose to move on to the second point in our appeal.
I do have a question about your first argument. I noticed from, if I remember correctly, that you did not use the term preemption in your brief.
Correct,
Your
Honor.
Can you tell us why you chose not to use that term?
We are not arguing that a claim for abuse of process is preempted. A state law claim for abuse of process can be brought, just not in the state court. It can be brought in the federal court under the federal court's umbrella authority to hear state court claims under the title of, or under the rubric of, adversary proceedings. And as we've shown from the Ninth Circuit opinion in Gonzalez versus Parks and the decisions of eight other states, that is virtually the unanimous law throughout the United States. There's one lonely case to the contrary. So it's really not a preemption issue, Your Honor. The state law claim doesn't disappear. It does exist, and it can be brought, just not in state court. The state court lacks the subject matter jurisdiction to hear and adjudicate that claim. Unless there's a follow-up question on abuse of process, I would propose to move on to my second point, which is that the erroneous submission to the jury of the claim for abuse of process by itself requires reversal of the entire judgment. Now, we made this point in our opening brief, of course, and the plaintiff's sole response was that in making this argument, we were engaging in forbidden speculation. No speculation was involved, however. On the contrary, it's the plaintiff's position that is founded on speculation. The plaintiffs apparently contend that we can tell as a matter of law that even in the absence of the abuse of process claim, that the jury would have arrived at exactly the same result on the other claims. I would like to tell you why that is not so. In many cases, the plaintiff asserts a single set of damages and may assert multiple legal theories for recovering the same damages, multiple claims for relief. If the plaintiff were to win on any one of them, the damages would be exactly the same. This case is quite different. Here, the plaintiffs allege different damages attributable to different claims based on different sets of facts. For example, let's look at the damages for emotional distress first, for which the jury awarded $400,000. By that award, the $400,000 was written in only one place. It was written in the single verdict form against Mr. Knight personally for abuse of process. It was written nowhere else, not as to any of the other claims. In response to oral questioning by the court, the jury confirmed that they intended to award exactly the same amount of damages on all the claims and against both defendants. But if we take the jury at its word, as we must, the jury apparently thought that the proper amount of damages for abuse of process was $400,000. Because that's what they wrote on the verdict form. But as plaintiffs readily acknowledge, the abuse of process claim is based on events that happened in late 2005 and early 2006. That was in the matters involving reopening of the bankruptcy. But plaintiffs also claim emotional distress based on, for example, their claim for outrageous conduct. But let's look at the facts that that's based on. That was based on the allegedly an abusive or improper manner in which she was told of her termination, that is, that she was in her car on the way to the hospital. And so her emotional distress on that claim arose and occurred at the time of that drive to the hospital, which was in 2003, 2.5 years earlier. So if the $400,000 in emotional distress is attributable to abusive process, as the jury wrote on the form, and there is nothing left over for the outrageous conduct claim, emotional distress. Or to put it another way, in the absence of the abusive process claim, there is absolutely no way to know how much, if anything, the jury would have awarded for outrageous conduct. And the same analysis holds true of every single other claim. For example, the fraud...
Mr. Lowe, let me just interject a question. Sorry to interrupt.
Not at all.
Let's assume for the sake of argument that the court agrees with you on the abusive process claim, the jurisdictional question. Would it be appropriate, given the way the jury filled out the question on damages, for a remand for a trial on damages only?
Oh, no, Your Honor. Oh, absolutely not. This situation is irremediable, short of a new trial. And, of course, in the second half of our brief, we argue that we're entitled to a directed verdict on each and every claim.
I understand.
But this verdict form is an absolute mess. There is no way to know what the jury would have done. The abusive process...
Well, let me just follow up, because I want to narrow it down a little bit. Because the jury... did find against General Steele on the claims.
Yes.
It just didn't, the damages piece is what's a little confusing here.
Well, yes, but as we showed in the briefs, I think, the abusive process claim essentially took over the trial.
I understand.
And so when you take out the thing that impressed the judge the most and that was the first item argued in closing, and was the subject of the most emotional advocacy during the trial, it seems to me unreasonable to think that there would be no effect on the jury. I think it is quite reasonable to believe that this was such a major part of the trial that when the abusive process and all of the negative evidence in connection with the abusive process claim is taken out of the trial, it's a whole different case. And I wouldn't accept for a second that we would automatically lose on liability in a second trial without the abusive process claim. And I think that's why fairness and due process requires that we have a fair trial without the presence of a highly prejudicial claim polluting the entire trial. And
Mr. Lowe, to what extent did counsel for General Steele raise an objection to the trial court about the way in which the interrogatories were answered or the clarification by the trial court of the jurors with regard to their answers?
General Steele's counsel didn't object to that, Your Honor, but there's nothing really wrong with that. The verdict form came back in a confused and confusing way, and the trial court did its best to make sense out of it, inquiring of the jury what they meant. And the jury said what they said, but their answers to the questions, I think, require reversal because they make no sense.
Well, was there, what I'm trying to determine from you is whether there was any obligation on the part of counsel for General Steele to ask the trial court to further inquire of the jurors so that the very issues that you're raising now on appeal might have been clarified in the trial court.
The case law on when further inquiry might be required is very thin in Colorado. But as I understand it, in general, where the conflict and where the problems result from the substance, that is, the very way that the jury decided the claims, that is an irremediable situation and that it requires a new trial. Now, if there were some formal problem, that can be corrected through further inquiry.
Well, I don't understand why you're suggesting that the problem was irremediable, because you've just explained to us the inconsistencies in the jury's explanation and the verdict forms that filled out. And I would think that if the trial court had explored that further, that there would be a number of possibilities, including sending the jury back to the jury room to properly fill out the interrogatories that had been given.
Your Honor, you can send the jury back to the jury room to correct a formal problem. For example, if they wrote an award of damages for the plaintiff on a line that was reserved for finding judgment in favor of the defendant, those kinds of things can be corrected. But where the problem is that the court and or the parties perceive that the judgment doesn't make a lot of sense, you can't tell the jury, your judgment doesn't make any sense to me. I want you to reach a different verdict.
But they didn't fill out under each of the verdict forms the amounts on all the other claims. Isn't that correct?
That is correct, and they explained to the judge that they believe that they were required to do so by the jury instructions, which said only award the same damages once. And their understanding of that was we shouldn't write the amount, the same amount, which they clearly intended to do, and they said they intended to do, on every form. So I'm treating this as though they had written the same amount on every form. We can divine a little bit about what happened. Obviously, they went to the abusive process claim first, because that's the one they filled out in full. But when they say, yeah, we intended to write this, I mean, the same damages on every form, it might as well have been written right in there. That's not the problem. The problem is that if the $400,000 for abusive process doesn't square with them saying, well, the same $400,000 is awarded for a completely different incident. And the same thing is true of the economic damages. The economic damages are written down on abusive process. And it was the exact amount calculated by the plaintiff's expert witness on wage loss. But the wage loss started on the day after termination. But the abusive process allegedly didn't occur until 2.5 or 3 years later. There is no way on earth that 3 years of wage loss between termination and the events of abusive process could possibly have caused wage loss over the past 3 years. It's impossible. And so this verdict and the verdict form is a complete mess. I think a lot of it is attributable to the abusive process claim, which never should have been there. And without that claim, I submit that we need reversal and, at a minimum, a new trial, and, of course, we say a directed verdict. I see I have 3.5 minutes left, roughly, and I'd like to reserve that if possible.
Very well, Mr. Lowe. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court and counsel. Good afternoon. I'm Daryl Kilmer of the law firm of Kilmer, Lane & Newman, and I represent Ms. Simmons in this appeal. We also represented Ms. Simmons at the trial level in this case, and I've been interested to watch the evolution of this case as it's been described by our opponents, not only throughout the course of the trial, but now on appeal. One would think that what happened was that the abusive process tort took over, swallowed up the rest of the case, and we just took that ball and ran with it. But that is far from the case. Indeed, the abusive process tort was always, I don't want to minimize the significance of it by calling it an afterthought, but it definitely did not take over the litigation of this case. It occurred at the very end during the sequence of the trial and the presentation of the witnesses and the exhibits. It happened only on the last day. There were only a couple of witnesses dedicated to it. That was the witnesses, the lawyers who had devised the scheme and tried to derail the trial. But by and large, this was a standard garden variety wrongful discharge and violation of public policy tort. Sometimes we shorthand this by calling it retaliatory termination because it was motivated illegally. It was motivated because Ms. Simmons had engaged in conduct that she had every legal right to do, and she was retaliated against for doing it. That generated several torts, and each of these torts yielded the same type of damages. So if you set aside for the moment the abusive process tort, you have a wrongful termination violation of public policy that had $240,300 in damages. Expert testimony indicated these actual economic losses. It was undisputed. That amount of damages is awardable independent of any abusive process under either the wrongful discharge tort or the fraud tort or the outrageous conduct tort, and I'll talk more about that in detail in a moment.
Mr. Kilmer, just for clarification, so are you saying that the damages for all of the torts except the abusive process were the same?
Yes, that is absolutely correct.
So am I correct in inferring from that that the damages for the abusive process might be different?
I can understand the argument. If we were to go into the jury's thinking on the actual economic loss, I can understand that argument. On the emotional distress damages, I'm going to indicate the far more likely jury speculation as to how they came up with this, but the economic loss would have been different. But the other six, there were eight claims for relief. at plus two abusive process claims, abusive process both against the company and against Mr. Knight himself. But the six first claims were all termination claims. And the jury was instructed very clearly, and they followed this instruction, although there are multiple claims for relief, many of them seek the same damages, and you can only award those damages one time. And that's exactly what they did. And there were eight claims for relief. The last two were the abusive process. And it seems pretty clear what they did was they went through the jury verdict form in order and found for the plaintiff on each of those eight. And then they said, we've been instructed to find what Ms. Simmons's damages are under these circumstances. Well, there's $240,300 in damages because she lost her job. So her actual losses are $240,300. We can only award that once. Let's write it down. What were her emotional distress damages? And the jury determined those were $400,000 given this totality of circumstances. That is supported by the record. Now, General Steel and Knight have not come up with a single case to support the proposition that a jury is acting erroneously or that they were badly instructed, although there was no objection to the instructions, if they decide that the course of conduct yielded X number of dollars in emotional distress damages. And that's clearly what they did. And the law clearly allows it. In fact, the law demands it on some of these torts. Outrageous conduct, for example, wasn't a completed tort the moment it was that she was terminated. The outrageous conduct tort assumes how was she treated while she was there? How was she treated during the recruitment process, which was dishonestly? How was she terminated? When was she terminated? And thereafter, all of that could be fairly embraced by outrageous conduct. And the jury was well within their power to say the treatment that she received that are captured by these torts yields a $400,000 emotional distress award. Next question. What level of punitive damages do we believe ought to be inflicted upon General Steel to make them stop this type of conduct against people? And they came up with $800,000. And Judge Munsinger found that to be a legitimate, defensible amount. In fact, Judge Munsinger decided to double that based upon his findings under Colorado statute giving him authority to do that. So it's simply wrong to suggest that somehow the abusive process tort took this over, the jury became wild-eyed and stopped following the judge's instructions, which weren't objected to by and large, and were sort of overcome by passion because of a closing argument or something like that. All of these are independently supportable, with the possible exception of the economic loss under the abusive contract, abusive process tort. And I'm suggesting that an equally viable, actually a more viable speculation as to what the jury was doing when it wrote down the one number because they were told to only award it once was to say, this is the total amount of economic loss for this treatment we've just found in favor of Ms. Simmons eight times.
Well, Mr. Kilmer, given the widely discrepant views that you and Mr. Lowe have on this, is there a case law that supports your position saying that we should surmise what the jurors did the way you're suggesting and therefore say that it was appropriate as opposed to what Mr. Lowe is suggesting?
Indeed, there is not. And I think that any of this speculation into what must the jury have been thinking is inappropriate speculation. My only suggestion was Mr. Lowe's speculation about the jury, what must have been thinking, defies common sense. It's not even the most obvious result of it. But Judge Taubman, you're entirely correct that this is an inappropriate exercise for us to be engaging in any event. And the case law is completely barren to support Mr. Lowe's argument that we have to break down each of the claims for relief that the jury found in our favor and have them independently support each of the different components of the damage. No case is cited in either the opening brief by the defendant or the reply brief. I haven't been able to find any, and certainly they didn't argue that at the district court, so in any event, if a case is out there free-floating somewhere, it was badly waived at the trial level.
Mr. Kilmer, while you still have time, could you please address the subject matter jurisdiction issue?
Yes. The federal courts have subject matter jurisdiction in the first instance over bankruptcy cases, including bankruptcy cases that include within them an abusive process. But the scope of the exclusive jurisdiction of the federal courts is defined by the filing of the bankruptcy petition. When somebody files for bankruptcy, that defines the bankruptcy estate. Any claims that she might have at the time of the filing are included in the bankruptcy estate, and you can't try to litigate those through the state courts. In this case, the abuse of process claim did not show up until not only had the bankruptcy claim been opened, but it had been closed in May of 2005. And then it had been reopened wrongly in 2005, in December of 2005, about a week before the trial. Even then, the abuse of process claim wasn't extant, because it only became extant when that stay, which was improperly and fraudulently secured in the bankruptcy court, the federal bankruptcy court, was walked over to Judge Munsinger and said, see, now we can't go to trial. That's the only time that this tort had become a completed tort. It was not part of any bankruptcy estate, either in the first initiation of the bankruptcy, which was already closed, or in the reopening of it.
Do you agree with Mr. Lowe that the issue here is not one of preemption, but one of subject matter jurisdiction that's distinct?
I think that is probably correct. I'd need to give that some thought as to the differences between those. Since they had been arguing that this is a subject matter jurisdiction argument, we were responding by saying, of course the district court has jurisdiction to make sure that its own proceedings, the state district court, are not abused by improper use of a stay which was fraudulently obtained. It wouldn't have been preempted either, although obviously we didn't cite the cases specifically to preemption because they weren't raised ever by the defendant. I do think, since I have a little bit of time left, I'm not going to take it all, but I do want to make clear one thing, because I suspect that Mr. Lowe might return to it in his rebuttal, although it wasn't addressed in his primary argument. And that is this distinction between the improper motive, which doesn't seem to be terribly at issue here, and an improper use of the process, which their supplemental authority addressed in their reply brief focused on. In this case, there was substantial improper use of the process, and this was found by the jury for sure, and beyond a reasonable doubt, in order to get the punitive damages that were awarded on that tort, but also independently by Judge Munsinger, and he found that also by the higher standard of proof, clear and convincing evidence. The stay itself was fraudulently obtained by improper use of the bankruptcy trustee, which in this story is a vehicle that one goes through the bankruptcy, Chapter 7 bankruptcy process with, and the improper use of the federal bankruptcy court to obtain a stay. Now, the defendants have argued that a stay is intended to stay proceedings, so there's no improper use of a stay if you then use it to slow down proceedings. But that's just a tricky argument. What really happened was they took this fraudulently obtained stay, they went and gave it to Judge Munsinger without giving him the full facts that were extant at that point, and it was right before the trial. And based upon this, Judge Munsinger felt he had no choice except, it looks to him like she had just filed bankruptcy like maybe that week, and he was being notified of that. So in fact, he did delay the trial, he vacated the trial date, and the rest is history. But that was an improper use of the stay. A typical use of a stay in bankruptcy proceeding is to protect the debtor. If I'm the debtor and I've got people suing me for collection actions, a lot of people coming after me, more than my assets might tolerate, then I will file for bankruptcy, and that automatically stays these collection efforts against me. It is to protect the debtor so that we can sort of in an organized fashion figure out how these debts are best going to be paid. Maybe it's going to be pro rata or something. In this instance, the stay was used in its exact opposite intended fashion. It was used as a sword against Sandy Simmons, who had been the debtor back when there had been a bankruptcy case that was pending. It protected neither Ms. Simmons. In fact, it hurt her because she lost her opportunity for a faster opportunity to have her claims resolved. it actually didn't help the creditors either, because the offer was preposterously low. General Steele had come in and said, geez, you've got this lawsuit, it's a valueless claim, we'll give you $10,000 for it. Well, we have found out that it isn't exactly a valueless claim, the jury found otherwise, for example, and that wouldn't have helped the creditors at all, and it was being used by somebody who wasn't even involved in the bankruptcy at all. General Steele and Knight had conspired to come up with this idea to stop Ms. Simmons from actually generating that asset, some value for that asset, hurting Ms. Simmons and hurting the creditors, and only helping General Steele, which was neither a creditor and certainly they weren't the debtor. That's the improper use that I feared upon last night reviewing our pleadings that we weren't entirely clear on. So unless there are other questions from the court, we would stand on our responses to the rest of the pleadings, and we would ask the court affirm the jury verdict and the court's verdict in the court below. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kilmer.
Mr. Kilmer has just conceded that there was a real problem with respect to the economic damages not being attributable to the abuse of process claim, and he acknowledges that that was incorrect. But he stoutly maintains that the non-economic damages for emotional distress were fine and that they could be attributed to all of the tort claims collectively. Well, let's analyze that a little more closely. Since the abuse of process and the outrageous conduct occurred at two different times, separated by several years, no doubt that she would have experienced two separate episodes of emotional distress. So of that $400,000, I ask myself, how much of that is attributable to the abuse of process? I don't know. We can't tell. How much of it is attributable to, say, outrageous conduct or wrongful termination or any of the other? I can't tell, and I don't think anyone else can either.
Mr. Lower, are there cases that you're aware of, or maybe you cited them in your brief, and I don't recall them right now, that deal with situations like this where the jurors did not answer interrogatories correctly and the court had to determine whether their verdict was appropriate or not?
We never conceived of the issue as that way, as the court, as Your Honor just expressed it. We conceived of it more as we know what the jury intended to do because part of it was written down and the judge asked them and they told them as though they wrote it. The problem is that their substantive decisions cannot really be squared with each other, and even that isn't the full issue. The full issue is that when you take away the big claim that they did write down, you can't tell what they would have done with the rest.
Well, when you say we know what the jury intended to do, it sounds like you and Mr. Kilmer have diametrically opposed views about that issue.
Well, all I know is what they said. And I'm going no further than that. And that is, they said that they were awarding the same amount of dollars against each defendant on all claims. And I go no further than that. Because, as Mr. Kilmer says, we don't want to speculate. So let me quickly go through some of the other points that he made. I'm going to jump to the end on the substantive abuse of process. He accuses us of not giving the full facts to Judge Munsinger and allowing the judge to think that the reopened bankruptcy claim was, in fact, the first petition. If we had been more careful and explained everything, it would have been far worse for his client. The fact is that his client seriously breached the bankruptcy rules by failing to notify either Judge Munsinger or us, General Steele and his counsel, of the fact that she had a pending bankruptcy claim in the middle of her state court litigation. If you go to page 22, Mr. Kilmer's brief, you will see that he concedes correctly that upon the filing of petition for bankruptcy, the trustee succeeds to the ownership of all property, including causes of action. And this is very well established. There's a Colorado Court of Appeals case by Judge Roy on point, In re Yates, but it's clearly the law, clearly the law. She never did that. She tried to sneak her bankruptcy through under the radar, and the only reason this all happened, and the only reason we had to go back and reopen, was because she had tried to hide her bankruptcy, and I see that my time has expired, so I will stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lowe. Thank you again, Mr. Kilmer. We appreciate both of your fine arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. That concludes the arguments this afternoon for Division One. So the court will be in recess, and the bailiff may so announce.